My name is Tim Ormsby. I'm running for the 3rd Legislative District House seat, position number 2.
You are a popular guy in Olympia because you know an awful lot about the budget. Can you tell me about being the guy who kind of leads the effort to write the state house budget every couple of years?
The budget, the state budget, is, you know, probably the single most important bill regularly that the legislature passes. It's the only constitutionally required legislation that we have to have. We have to come up with a budget. There are a lot of other very important policy bills and other things that happen, but that is the crux of the reason for the legislature to convene. As chair of the House Appropriations Committee, I will say that it is a management job. We have more than one third of the members of the legislature, of the House chamber, that sit on the Appropriations Committee. So 33 of the 98 members of the House are also members of the Appropriations Committee. So it is managing those people and their interests and the interests of the people that elected them to come and speak on their behalf.
So I know this is more civics lesson than campaign interview, but I want to follow this for a few minutes just for folks' edification. When do you start writing the budget? Do you start writing it now, or do you wait until you get into Olympia in January?
Right now, we're doing all the preliminary work. So this is where I liken it to my job when I was finishing concrete. So a lot of work goes into getting that concrete pour right before the concrete truck ever shows up. So we're doing that preparation work. We're familiarizing ourselves with the changing dynamic. And this is one of those years where the dynamic is changing rapidly and in way different ways than we would have imagined a year ago. So it is adjusting to the current times. So that preparation period, that setup, is an ongoing process. And this is a particularly difficult year to reset our frame of reference as we approach that single most important bill.
So looking back, when the coronavirus hit and the legislature was in session there and had lots of different priorities, how did your job change when it became very clear that the coronavirus was going to take some money to adjust to?
We made significant changes. So just in a time frame, we got the economic and revenue forecast in the middle of February. And about a week later, I'm going to say it was February 17th or 19th, something like that. The coronavirus was a known thing, but it had not been quantified. And then we started seeing ramifications. We started seeing changes after that revenue forecast came out. We had a conversation with the state economist who presents the revenue forecast about 10 days later, and he informed us that what had been presented and approved to the forecast council was now functionally obsolete because of the economic changes that had resulted in COVID's reality. So our budget had been, the House and Senate had released their respective budgets. So we had to spend a good deal of time from that point at about February 24th until the budgets were approved on March 12th of reducing state expenditures by about $1 billion in that very short period of time. And subsequent to the legislature passing the budget, more devastating information became aware. The governor took appropriate action in vetoing some of the spending measures that were in the bill. And so it has been a process that began the day after the legislature adjourned, when the governor issued his orders to shut down school buildings for the public safety for not spreading the virus. So a lot has changed. And it began at the end of February and is ongoing.
So there were a lot of calls for a special legislative session to continue to further adjust spending sort of in mid-year. The governor decided not to. Is that the right move, do you think?
It turns out that it was the right move. I was in favor of the legislature convening. And let me just say, that is easy for me to say because I'm not the House administration that would have had to logistically figure out how you convene 98 members virtually and have them vote and weigh in. That would have been a complete and wholesale turnaround from everything that we've ever done. So I was in favor of us making whatever adjustments we could in a timely fashion to adjust the future liability, which is, that's not a great word, liability, but the future responsibility that the state would have for funding critical programs and services. I thought that any trajectory, if we could lower the trajectory of some of that, it would put us in a better position. That was not the governor's choice either in June or in August, which were the two kind of targeted dates. I will say now that we have the benefit of hindsight, that was the right call.
Why so?
Because what ended up happening between June and September was half of our problem statement was removed from the economic forecast. Our state economist produced an economic forecast in June that was based on best information, but was very pessimistic considering what reality ended up happening. That change in the reality of consumer confidence, the unemployment insurance going out to people who could then spend it on, you know, those activities of daily life that you need to for groceries and rent and the rest of it. And when it was re-racked and reevaluated in September, that's when that very dire June forecast problem statement was cut in half. So I would say that we would have been making decisions based on a worst case scenario that did not become that did not come to pass. And we have gotten better information. But let me interject here. One thing that would provide us with a lot more certainty right now is for Congress and this administration to get off their duffs and do what they need to do, which the chairman of the Fed said, this is the time when the federal government has to make investments. For all the uncertainty that we are facing as budget writers and uncertainty families are facing, trying to make ends meet in their own household could be relieved by a major factor if the U.S. Senate and this administration would play ball and get some relief to state and local governments.
So that's still an open question. And so you can't obviously assume something like that's going to happen. Assume nothing does happen. What sort of situation do you step into in January in terms of the budget? And if there's a big deficit, how do you fix it?
So what we have talked about ongoing, and this is Republicans and Democrats, House and Senate, was we have the good fortune of having a very healthy rainy day fund, the budget stabilization account. What we learned from the September economic revenue forecast was that there is enough in that rainy day fund for the state to be able to do everything that we promised to do in the budget that we passed last March 12th. We could use the rainy day fund to get us to the end of this fiscal year, which ends June 30th. There would still be money left over in the rainy day fund to fill in some of the gap for the upcoming two-year cycle, the biennial budget, which begins next July 1, that would be July 1, 2021, and ends June 30th, 2023. But we would still have a gap in that upcoming two-year budget of about $1.5 billion. So that's what we're focused on now. We can limp through this fiscal year with the promises that were made in the state budget last March without doing wholesale damage, and then turn our eye to the prospects of resolving the problem statement that will begin on July 1 of next year.
And then there are the questions of, do we need to raise taxes? Do we need to raise more revenue? And there are some in your party who have talked about a wealth tax. What do you think about a wealth tax?
You know, this is not me punting on this, Doug, but the the Appropriations Committee is the spending committee, and we can't spend unless there are the resources to do it. But in the House, those responsibilities are divided between the Appropriations Committee, which is spending, and the Finance Committee, which is revenue. That could be fees. It could any type of tax treatments, could be tax exemptions, tax increases, fee increases. That's the purview of the Finance Committee. And I'm trying to stay in my lane on this. I have a very vested interest in that revenue conversation. And what we have done in the past, and I'm a fan of, is deciding what does this document, the state budget, which is a reflection of our collective values, what do we need to have in that budget to fulfill the promises to our constituents about the programs and services that we are there to provide? We identify what that number is, and then we reverse engineer a revenue proposal to fill that. So let's keep our eyes on our principles and values and not get lost in the minutiae of which percentage of this and which percentage of that and what increase and what decrease, all the rest of that. And the advantage to being a simple-minded individual as I am is let's focus on the important stuff. It's all interesting. Let's focus on the important stuff. And the important stuff is getting people the programs and services, especially during these uncertain times, that they expect and that we owe to them.
Well, let me then hit you with a couple of areas where I've heard people say we need to spend more money. One is on public health, with the need to have a dedicated revenue source to make sure that local public health districts like Spokane's have the resources they need to be able to go and handle a pandemic. Do you think that public health is going to see more attention in the legislature next year?
The public health received a lot of attention earlier this year in the budget. So one of the things that we did on a bipartisan, bicameral, Republicans, Democrats, House and Senate agreed to $200 million because we had enough information about COVID at that time to know that we were going to face a bunch of uncertainty. So a bunch of money was plugged into the public health system. And I can say that nobody in the legislature is bragging about the treatment of public health over the last several years. Let's remember, public health was not an issue when it was funded by car tabs. Then all of a sudden we got $30 car tabs and public health took a shot in the solar plexus and has not recovered. And that's been 20 years. So we have been trying to patchwork piecemeal together a robust public health service in those intervening years. And it's coming out of the general fund. And we have made really good improvements in public health. And I'm not here to brag about how good they are. I'm just saying they were way better than they had been going back to 2015, 2016. So all those improvements aside, we have a gap yet to fill to provide the public with the assurance that their collective public health is being monitored and monitored accurately. And one of the things that's lost on folks is public health has a lot of responsibilities outside of things like the pandemic, like checking the water quality in various wells and water systems, checking to make sure that, on children's health, monitoring and providing services for those folks suffering from substance use disorder. So they have a wide portfolio of responsibilities. And this pandemic highlighted one component of that. There are several other things we need to mind in the public health arena.
So the second area is wildfire prevention and mitigation. That became very clear again around Labor Day. And earlier today, Hillary Franz was saying that she intends to go before the legislature next year and push for a dedicated fund for wildfire mitigation and suppression. Do you think that is going to play a bigger role in the budget next year?
Well, maybe the third time's the charm, because it's been tried twice with various schemes. And I have no objection to having a dedicated funding source. Other than in tough times, things get undedicated pretty quick. So if there's a major shortfall, the legislature, can undedicate things. So the assurance that folks would like to have is that this money will, in perpetuity, always go for this thing. And that isn't always the case. It is the case with trust funds like the Labor and Industries Workers Comp stuff or the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund. But unless it says trust fund after it, it is at the whim of the legislature to dedicate or undedicate it to a specific cause.
So are you in charge of working mostly on the general fund budget, but do you also do the transportation and capital budgets as well?
No, just the what we call the near general fund. So just the general fund dollars. So transportation, both the revenue and expenditures are within the transportation committee in both the House and the Senate. And the capital budget, which is our construction budget, is a separate committee in the House with its own leadership and membership and staff. In the Senate, both in the House, we have separate committees for appropriations, spending, finance, revenue, and capital construction. Three separate committees. In the Senate, it is all three of those functions are within the Senate Ways and Means Committee.
I ask that because you'd mentioned $30 car tabs, and I'm thinking with that going back into effect, that money that had been there for transportation may not be there now. And do you think that there will be talks about other revenue sources to kind of fill in for some of those transportation dollars that may be lost?
Well, I'm going to do a little role reversal with you, Doug, and just ask you, is it a foregone conclusion that those $30 car tab lawsuit is settled?
Oh, maybe I'm obviously then projecting something that I don't know what I'm talking about.
No, you do. You are on top of things as good as anybody I know. Maybe you had information that I had not heard. So I believe that the $30 car tab litigation is still in front of the Washington State Supreme Court, if I am not mistaken. I'll be corrected if that's inaccurate. So that is unresolved, but your point is well taken, and that is that transportation is also suffering a huge revenue shortfall. We were hemorrhaging $100 million a month during the initial period of the COVID shutdown because fuel tax, we were getting months to the gallon, not miles to the gallon during that period of very little activity. And a huge component of that I was not aware of until it got shut down was the car rental tax. So when people come from out of state or come from a different community and rent a car, that was a huge revenue source. And that went in the toilet during that period where there was very little economic activity. So transportation revenue has got to be resolved. We, in my understanding and in this capacity, I am just but another member receiving briefings from our transportation subject matter experts, that we can get through this current period, this budget period that we're in, but we're going to be having to make difficult decisions in the next budget period, which again would begin on July 1, to resolve the transportation revenue shortfall. And my personal opinion is that it's going to need to focus on operation and maintenance and not go to those shiny, sparkly new projects, which members love, the public loves, but we've got some deferred maintenance out there on roads and bridges. So Department of Transportation will do what the legislature says with the money they get. They are suffering a backlog of deferred maintenance that keeps me awake at night when cars and trucks, pedestrians and bicycles are potentially driving commuting on potentially unsafe roadways. So I think we need to have a focus on upkeep as much as we need to focus on the really sexy things, which are new projects.
So what does that mean for finishing the North-South Freeway?
Well, that's when I get a little parochial, because I'm going to go ahead and throw some sharp elbows in this discussion. And the North-South Freeway, the North-South Corridor, is very important in this community. Other projects, other transportation projects, and other communities are also very important. We have the good fortune of having Representative Marcus Riccielli, my House seatmate from the 3rd Legislative District, involved in the budget reconciliation process, both on the spending and revenue side on the House Transportation Committee. And he is our local subject matter expert, my go-to person. I think that Marcus has been very successful up to now, and I will fill any role to do a shameless parochial plug for my community in this arena, because our folks expect it. And it's been a long time coming, and we finally got to the point where we saw the light at the end of the tunnel, only to have COVID hit the fan.
So we've been talking finances for the first 20 minutes or so. I just want to do a quick pivot to police reform. And the governor has a commission that's been working on accountability, transparency for police. Where do you think the legislature, what is the legislature's appropriate role here? Is it more of a local, is this more of a local discussion? Is a statewide discussion? Do you support chokehold restrictions, tear gas, that sort of thing? Where do you fall on this whole issue?
I think that it is a statewide issue, and components of the law enforcement reform have to happen at the state level, in my opinion, because it involves every community. And part of this is folks that might transition from one law enforcement agency to another, having had, you know, maybe behavior issues at the previous one that are then not known by the new agency. And I think that requires a statewide approach. I am personally in favor of removing chokeholds. There are issues there with what other means might they use that could be even be worse outcomes for the individual that, you know, they're encountering. But I don't think that we need chokeholds. I also am in favor of removing the utilization of tear gas, and not having the confrontation culture of protesters versus law enforcement.
So I've been asking this kind of to finish with all the candidates. You're asking for other people's votes, but when you have the ballot in your hand, what are the qualities that you look for in other candidates?
That is a great question. And what I look for is outcomes. I'm not looking for flash, splash, shiny or sparkly. I'm looking for outcomes. I'm not looking for someone with good rhetoric. I'm looking for someone that laces up their boots and shows up to work and doesn't go home until they've accomplished something. And I'm looking for a workhorse, not a show horse. And those are the qualities I look for. And I am just very proud to say that I see that in the legislature day in and day out. Those aren't the folks that get the attention. They're not the ones that get the quotes in the paper or the spots on the television story, but they are the folks that show up and do their job for and approach it as not a job, but a vocation, a devotion, in fact, that they are there for the right reasons. And I see that in on both sides of the aisle and in both chambers, but they may not be widely recognized by the general public, because they're not going to tackle people on their way to the microphone.
So then during a political campaign, how do you spot those folks?
That is a good question. And I think we look to folks' records. And as you began our discussion talking about civics, that is a lost art in my mind, where we have relied on, you know, some of the more superficial exposures to people and what they stand for. I have the benefit of having a long legislative track record, which I am happy to stand by. And it, by the way, is not mistake-free, Doug, but I will stand by it for the approach that I have taken, keeping in mind the folks that don't have a dominant voice in the community I was sent to Olympia to represent. And I am looking for those folks that frankly can't vote, children, for example, that may very well be in harm's way, folks that don't have the means and the wherewithal to support themselves adequately. And unless and until we are ready to have disposable people, we need to take care of people how and where we find them and set them on a trajectory to success as much as we possibly can. That's going to take all of us. And so, you know, excuse me for getting a little off topic here, but I am looking for folks to do their job in finding out through credible sources. And this doesn't necessarily involve Facebook posts or Breitbart or InfoWars or QAnon or any left-wing site, as far as that goes. This has to do with folks seeing how those individuals are interpreting their responsibilities locally and in a statewide fashion, and how and whether it meets their criteria for the values and principles they want to see espoused on their behalf.